The first case on the docket this morning is John Chatsnoff versus the St. Louis Board of Police Commissioners and others.
It's actually a consolidated appeal, Your Honor, with the second appeal being Wendell Ishman et al. Versus the St. Louis Board of Police Commissioners and John Chatsnoff. I'm Mary Bruntrager, and I'm representing the individual policeman, police officer plaintiffs, which are Wendell Ishman et al. The appellants, including Mr. Lawson, who represents the Board of Police Commissioners, request for full time 15 and 3 rebuttal, and we're going to divide the time 10 for the Ishman plaintiffs and 5 for the Board of Police Commissioners.
I'm Anthony Rothard with Police Grant Covey. We represent John Chatsnoff, the respondent in both appeals, and we would like our full time.
Very well. Our second case on the docket this morning is Sheila Webster versus Ace American Insurance Company, doing business as Alamo Rent and Car and Alamo Financial, and Greg Meyer, Allstate.
David Abney for the plaintiff, Your Honor, the appellant. I would like to, if I can do this, have 12 minutes for my opening comments and then reserve the remaining 5 minutes for rebuttal. If not, if that's acceptable.
You have 15 and 3.
Okay. If I use 12, can I have the 5 then?
Sorry. It's not like trial.
Sorry, thank you.
All right.
Russ Waters on behalf of ACE, and one of my partners, Cynthia Judiman, should be assisting on the to take the full 15 minutes.
Very well. And we will proceed with our first case. Ms. Bruntrager.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I represent the plaintiffs who are the four individual named police officers in the Ishman versus Board of Education case. And now there are 13 John Doe officers who brought suit against their employer, the St. Louis Board of Police Commissioners, to enjoin release of their internal affairs disciplinary records. The officers allege in their petition that they have a common law, constitutional, and legally protected privacy right in these records under Missouri law, which prevents the disclosure of the records to Mr. Chatsnoff by the board pursuant to Mr. Chatsnoff's earlier Sunshine Law claim. The police officers filed this current cause of action after this court in the previous Chatsnoff appeal ruled that the officers had no standing to sue under the Sunshine Law. But the court stayed the underlying judgment, the Chatsnoff judgment, and I'll refer to that as Chatsnoff 1 for simplicity's sake, pending resolution of the police officers' independent cause of action. In other words, the court stayed that judgment to allow the police officers to proceed in this claim. Now, before I address the merits of our appeal, I wanted to respond to this court's request in its order of February 19 to talk to the effect of the transfer of the police department to the city of St. Louis. As everyone knows, the police department used to be under the control of the Board of Police Commissioners. That's now been transferred to the city of St. Louis under new statutes. I do not speak for the board or the city of St. Louis. Mr. Lawson is their counsel. So I'm going to speak to our position as the plaintiff's individual police officers. We believe that the transfer does not affect the current litigation or this court's consideration of the merits of the appeal. Two reasons. First, under Rule 5213C of the Rules of Civil Procedure, an action may continue against an original transferor of interest. The parties are not summarily divested of the right to continue the litigation. And I cite the court to the U.S. Bank versus National Association versus Cox case, 341 Southwest 3rd, 846. That case said substitution was not necessary for the appeal to continue. Also, specifically in this case, there are enabling statutes which allowed this to happen, and that is 84345.1, which provides for the winding down of litigation by the board. And under the statute, the board is empowered to act through the secretary of the board, which happens to be Mr. Lawson, to wind down the board's affairs. And I'm quoting from the statute, the board shall continue to operate, and during that time, the Board of Police Commissioners shall designate and authorize its secretary to act on its behalf for the purposes of performing the board's duties and any other actions incident to the transfer and winding down of the board's affair. And as you may know, the transfer is far from complete. They are still working out the details. The city has assumed by ordinance legal liability for the contractual obligations and other legal obligations of the board. And as a practical matter, in this case, the board has already deposited the records that are in dispute in the circuit court. In fact, I think they're in Judge Durker's office and they're filed under seal. So any judgment reversing or affirming this case does not require the board to do anything more with regard to the records. They're already there with the court. I would also note that the new statute 84.0344.8 also transfers the disciplinary authority from the police board to the Civil Service Commission, and there is a new rule under the statute, or there's a new statute requiring the Civil Service Commission for their rules and regulations to provide that the records prepared for disciplinary purposes shall be confidential closed records available only to the Civil Service Commission. And that's 84.0344.8, and that will come up later in our discussion. Also, it's my understanding the Civil Service Commission has adopted Rule 7 of the board manual, which has also been extensively discussed in this appeal. So they're operating under the old board rules currently. In terms of the merits of our appeal, plaintiffs in point one seek reversal of the trial court's judgment because the trial court erred in holding that as a matter of law, public employees, including the police officers, have no legally recognizable or enforceable right to privacy in their disciplinary records under Missouri law. Now, Missouri courts have long recognized that there's a cause of action to protect a person's common law right to privacy, and this goes back to 1911, and we cite the Mundell versus Harris case. Although the Missouri Constitution does not specifically or explicitly provide for a right to privacy, this court in the Duckworth case, Duckworth versus Syed, 670 Southwest 2nd, 88, held that the right to privacy in Missouri has been recognized and developed by case law with its source in the Bill of Rights. Plaintiffs acknowledge that this is a case of first impression. There is no Missouri case that specifically recognizes a public employee's right to privacy in the disciplinary process outside of the context of a Sunshine Law claim.
Let me ask you a question. Can you tell me, in your pleading or in your proof that was adduced before Judge Durker, what type of information was ordered released that, to your judgment, might be of a personal or private character?
The 59 records at issue, which remain, are, in our opinion, records that were produced by the Internal Affairs Department solely for the purpose of internal disciplinary proceedings. And those were the Garrity statements, the advice of rights mm-hmm. forms, the internal affairs interdepartment correspondence.
Does all of the information relate to allegations of on-the-job misconduct?
Yes. All of the documents that are currently part of the 59 exhibits mm-hmm. relate to departmental charges, such as duty on becoming an officer, failure to supervise, those sorts of charges.
Would an employee of a private company be able to stop his employer from divulging papers relative to on-the-job misconduct that were truthful?
I believe if it's an employee in a private company.
Yes. Mm-hmm. In other words, someone steals a six-pack of soda and is fired from McDonald's as a fry cook?
Well, if it's part of if it's in the context of a litigation, like between the employee and the employer, or between the third party and the employee, and it's relevant to the litigation, he would not be able to prevent disclosure. If it's just a third party, I don't know how in the context of a private employee there would be an outside person.
The manager's a blabbermouth, and he didn't like this person anyway, and says this person stole soda and puts a sign up saying the person's a thief.
Then you would
And this is to the manager's judgment, truthful comment.
Then it would be in the realm of an invasion of privacy, and whether that the information was protected by a privacy interest, and whether he had a legitimate expectation of privacy in that. Mm-hmm. We are arguing on the context of public employees in the Sunshine Law case, they have a legitimate expectation of privacy in records which are exempt under the Sunshine Law. And that is backed up by this court in Daly, which held there's a constitutional right to privacy which extends to protect an individual's interest in preventing disclosure of personal matters.
What do you take the phrase personal matters to be?
Personal matters is defined by the Sunshine Law include...
Yeah, but you made it quite clear that your claim now is no longer under the Sunshine Law, I think.
Yes, but if a public employee has an expectation of privacy in records that can be closed under the Sunshine Law, you have to look to the Sunshine Law to see where he has a legitimate expectation of privacy. And I point the court to the North Kansas City Hospital case, which found the opposite. In that case, the court said that an individual's right to privacy, personal right to privacy, does not extend to open records because they can't have a right to privacy or an expectation of privacy in the open records. By reverse, a public employee would have an expectation of privacy in records that are closed under the Sunshine Law. And skipping ahead, because I'm, you know, running out of time, the court, another point of error we have with the court was that the court said, well, these are already declared to be open records because of the prior judgment. But that judgment does not have collateral estoppel effect on the Ishman plaintiffs. The Ishman plaintiffs weren't a party to that judgment. And under Wilkes versus...
Go ahead. I will allow
and
you
under,
to get that.
And under the Wilkes versus American Family case, the case we cite in the brief, you can't have collateral estoppel where there's not privity.
Let me ask you a question, and that is, if you were, you recognize that, I guess, that there's an inherent tension between Sunshine Law requests and privacy claims of public employees. How, to your judgment, should those competing claims be resolved?
Well, I think the legislature has resolved it. Where the legislature has allowed an exemption to the Sunshine Law, then the public employee has a right to privacy, and the public does not have a right to that information. And this court in Lout, you know, parsed what part of an investigative report is public record and what is not. And I point the court to our discussion of Lout in the brief. And I think that applies to this case. I don't think that the Ishman plaintiffs are summarily enjoined from saying that these are closed records because of the prior judgment on the part. I mean, they can argue that under the statutes they had an expectation of privacy because these fit under an exemption to the statute. It's not a relitigation of the prior claim. It's a litigation of their reasonable expectation of privacy.
I'm going to ask another question, if I may, and that is, do you know where the wording of the Garrity warning that was given these officers, where it originated from?
I do not, Your Honor.
Okay.
I just know that the Advice of Rights form has been something that's been given by the police department for many years, and it's not, it hasn't changed. And we're not arguing that it's the Fifth Amendment that gives a privilege or a constitutional protection. We're arguing that it was the board saying we're only using these for internal disciplinary purposes and not for a criminal proceeding, which gives the plaintiff an expectation of privacy in that statement.
Very well. Thank you. Mr. Lawson, I will afford you the same additional 2 minutes.
Understood. Did you want to say something?
Yes. Your time. I'm sorry.
All right.
No.
We're co-appellants?
Well, yeah. Let him go.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
All right.
Morning.
Keep the time.
Ask and you shall receive is a widely used biblical quote. And while the legal system and the Bible don't always see things the same way, maybe in this instance they do. Because traditionally, in order to receive something, you have to ask for it. And so for the trial court in this case to turn that principle on its head and sua sponte award $100,000 in attorney's fees to Mr. Chasnoff and the ACLU attorneys without there ever having been a special pleading of attorney's fees, without there ever having been a prayer for attorney's fees, without there ever having been a motion for attorney's fees, is contrary to that principle which is inherent in our legal system.
Let me ask you this threshold question we raised by notice to the parties. When police responsibilities were transferred to the city, did the city succeed to the board's place in this consolidated litigation?
I would say not as a matter of law, Your Honor. I believe there was never any formal order that substituted.
No, I understand that.
The city.
But you would agree that the city is bound by Judge Durker's judgment and whatever this court would decide by virtue of an opinion?
What I would say is the city has passed an ordinance that says that it accepts responsibility for contractual obligations, indebtedness, and I think I'm quoting this accurately, other lawful obligations of the Board of Police Commissioners. Now, whether that's been established here as other lawful obligations is not for me to say. The city may very well disagree with that conclusion.
Who do you represent?
I represent the Board of Police Commissioners and its members.
Mm-hmm. And not the city of St. Louis.
I do not represent the city of St. Louis. The city of St. Louis is not a party to this lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
So the Board of Police Commissioners since 2010 has been in the uncomfortable position of being the custodian of these records, being pulled on one side by Mr. Chasnoff and the ACLU attorneys, and being pulled on the other side by the police officers and their attorneys. And both have staked claim in their own ways to a decision on these records. The Mr. Chasnoff claims the judgment. Mm-hmm. The police officers claim there's a stay order enforcing, preventing the enforcement of that judgment. And the Board of Police Commissioners is caught in the middle. So I'm having difficulty with the trial court's characterization of the Board of Police Commissioners as the fall guy in this litigation. We would gladly, if we could have, let Mr. Chasnoff and the police officers fight this out directly if we weren't the custodians of these records.
You seem to agree that the board is sort of subject to competing claims here?
Yes.
And that is precisely the reason this court remanded and instructed that these matters be litigated together?
Yes.
Then how can you claim in your argument that the attorney's fees shouldn't be paid, that Mr. Chasnoff did not have an interest in this litigation? You're telling me that the production of the records couldn't be determined without this litigation, so how could Mr. Chasnoff enforce his prior judgment absent his intervention in this litigation?
Because the Spradlin case holds that attorney's fees are penal in nature and are to be strictly construed. Mm-hmm. And so what Mr. Chasnoff has been awarded by the trial court is apparently based on the Sunshine Law's attorney fee statute. In point of fact, he's being awarded attorney's fees in connection with a lawsuit that has been filed by the police officers. And the police officers have not filed it as a claim under the Sunshine Law. The police officers have filed it as a claim to keep those records closed in spite of the Sunshine Law.
Is there any way Mr. Chasnoff could enforce his prior judgment under the Sunshine Law absent his intervention? And if so, explain how.
I believe he had filed a motion to for a special order to enforce that judgment.
Yes. And our court said these matters need to be litigated together. It's virtually a matter of law, the case in this litigation, that these matters are related to each other.
And in point of fact, Your Honor, just as an aside, at one point when we were going through this rather convoluted situation in the lower court, I think this was when Judge Hagney was still the judge handling it, I had actually proposed to Judge Hagney and the attorneys that maybe the way to do this was for me to file on behalf of the board an interpleader action and name Mr. Chasnoff and the police officers as the parties, and they could make their own record and their own legal arguments. I have to say that that didn't get very much traction, but I was certainly willing to do that, and I think that would have resolved these issues without the board even being involved.
We would
ask the court to reverse the award of attorney's fees.
Mr. Rather.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. When important decisions about the conduct of public officials are made in secret and then hidden from the public, we as citizens lose the ability to be a check on the powers and control. And that's what this case is about. This case arises from the 2006 World Series in which several people who were arrested for scalping complained that the tickets that were seized from them as evidence were then used by police officers and police officers' friends to attend the World Series. There was an investigation by the police department, and in April of 2007, John Chasnoff made a request under the public records law for a copy of the incident report and the investigative report. He was given neither, and in June of 2007, he filed the first law, the Chasnoff case, which gave birth to all these years of litigation.
Let me ask you a question. I think the trial judge referred to you as an eminent civil libertarian.
Yes.
What privacy rights should an employee, a public employee, have in his employment, in his personnel records, to your judgment?
Well, I do believe that there could be an expectation of privacy in personal matters, such as medical information. There are statutes that make certain information private. The Federal Privacy Act makes Social Security numbers private. There are federal and state laws that make medical information private, HIV status, drug and alcohol treatment. That is information that could be in a personnel file to which there may be a reasonable expectation of privacy that would give rise to a constitutional right of privacy.
How should that competing claim be litigated if those same records are subject to a Sunshine Law request?
Well, I think in the Lout case, this court talked about when there is personal information that to which there is a right of privacy in an otherwise public record, about segregating that out and redacting the information that's personnel or that's personal information. Mm-hmm. The Sunshine Law doesn't talk about it. Talks about personnel records. It doesn't talk about personal information, and there's always even the provision 610.021 that provides for closure of personnel records is simply a permissive closure. So any employer, any public employer, can always, under the Sunshine Law, make personnel records public, just like the manager of McDonald's can. The Sunshine Law allows an employer to also close the records. But since it's always permissive and the employer or the future person in that position always has the option of opening the records, that itself cannot give rise to an expectation of privacy. The purpose of remand, the last time we were before this court, was, according to this court, to determine whether there were protected rights or interests of the police officers that demand adjustment to or modification of the June 7th, 2010 judgment. The June 7th, 2010 judgment was the one that found that the records at issue here, and I'm at a bit of a disadvantage. I'm the only one who hasn't seen them. But the trial court saw them in the first case and inspected them in camera in this case and made certain findings about them. But the court found that there was no information in those records. In 2010, the court found that those records were open records under the Sunshine Law because they were an investigative report. And that, you know, goes back to the Supreme Court's, Missouri Supreme Court's decision in Guyer, discussing the conflict between a personnel record and an investigative report. And the court found that this was an investigative report. So now on remand, we have to determine, the court was supposed to determine, Judge Durker was assigned to determine whether there are rights or interests of the police officer that required adjustment or modification of the June 7th, 2010 judgment. So there could be a common law right, a constitutional right, or a statutory right. There's no common law right to privacy in public records because there's no dispute these are public records. They were created by the government, for the government. They're retained by the government. They are public records. The only dispute is whether or not they are open or closed records. But at the common law, this court in Disabled Police Veterans Club said that all public records were, at the common law, open to the public for public inspection. So I don't think there could be a common law claim, you know, for that reason alone, because of the common law, the records would have been open. Even so, the Sunshine Law trumps the common law. You know, when there's a specific statute that that addresses the same issue that was covered by the common law, the statute trumps. So the second question could be whether or not there's a statutory expectation of privacy. So there's not been yet in this litigation any statute cited other than the Sunshine Law. The Sunshine Law, because it's permissive closure, I mean, we argue and believe very strongly that Judge Hagney was correct in 2010 when he found that these are open records under the Sunshine Law. But even if he was wrong, even if they are personnel records, not investigative records, that still does not create an expectation of privacy because it's only permissive closure. You know, there might be a hope of privacy or a possibility of privacy, but it can't rise to a constitutionally enforceable right. And there's been no other statute cited, which leaves the Constitution. And so there's been a, you know, a claim that some of these records might be subject to a constitutional right of privacy, and I can be sympathetic to the notion of a constitutional right of privacy, but here, you know, the findings of fact, Judge Durker, paragraph 6, he found that none of the police officers invoked his right to remain silent. And at paragraph 8, he found, based on his review of the records, that there were no promises of privacy ever made to the police officers. So, you know, for those reasons, there's nothing here that gives rise to a constitutional right of privacy.
Weren't the police officers told that their information would be kept confidential?
No. Judge Durker found that they were not. They were told that it would not be used as direct evidence in a criminal case, which is what New Jersey versus Garrity requires. And they were told it would be used for internal affairs purposes. But in the findings of fact, and again, I haven't seen the records, but in the findings of fact, Judge Durker found that there was never any promise of privacy or any information given one way or another what would happen if there was a Sunshine Law request. I'd like to turn to the question of attorney's fees that were awarded. In the confidential version of the August 6, 2014 amended judgment, the court made its findings of fact at paragraph 13 as relevant to attorney's fees. And the court found that the Board of Police Commissioners had thwarted from the beginning this public records request made 8 years ago by Mr. Chasnoff. Certainly there's ample evidence in the record for that. From a lot of it's contained in Judge Hagney's judgment. He explains the process and the representations that were made as the case initially went through. And then this court in the Ishman appeal found that a consent judgment was entered into by the Board of Police Commissioners and the police officers in an effort to thwart and evade the judgment that Mr. Chasnoff had obtained in 2010. I think there are three reasons why, legal reasons why attorney's fees were allowed to be awarded. And Judge Durker discussed the Sunshine Law reasons in paragraph 15 of his conclusions of law. The purpose of allowing attorney's fees in Sunshine Law cases where there's been a knowing violation of the Sunshine Law is to allow people to challenge knowing violations of the Sunshine Law. If you can win a case in 2010, but in 2015, you still have to be litigating and most people would have to pay a lawyer, no one's ever going to enforce the Sunshine Law, even against knowing violations. I would have done it for free, but most lawyers wouldn't. And we can't bring every Sunshine case every time there's a knowing violation. And so it really, chips away at the attorney's fees that were awarded in 2010 if nothing can be awarded for the next 5 years of defending that judgment. Mr. Lawson mentioned filing an interpleader action. The board did have an option, always, from the beginning of when they first received the Sunshine Law request, under 610.027.6, any government body that has any doubt about whether or not records can be closed can file its own declaratory action case in the circuit court to determine whether or not the records at issue are closed or not.
Do you agree with the principle that when there are competing claims of privacy interests and Sunshine Law requests, that those matters should always be joined together so that there can be a single litigation of the question?
I think that that's, yes. I think when it's possible that should happen. But in many cases, when someone makes a Sunshine Law request, as here, when Mr. Chasnoff made the request and got nothing in return, he, other than naming the custodian of the records, there was no one else to name in the Sunshine Law case. Now, this court in the original Chasnoff appeal said that no one else could be a party to that case, but I do think it makes some sense to allow anyone who might have a privacy interest to intervene at the beginning and to hear the case all at once.
Okay. I'm going to ask you for a second to return to the Garrity warning. Yes. And one of the things I want to know if any of the lawyers can, is where it came from, this exact wording. And I want to read to you one sentence and tell me what you think it means. I understand that all matters discussed are confidential, and that I shall not discuss or communicate any part of these matters to any other person other than my attorney without prior written permission from the command attorney and command internal affairs.
So my understanding is that that's no longer a part of the warning form, or that's been in and out over the years, and that that is the testimony, I recall the testimony on that point, was that that was a command on the police officer who was being interviewed not to share the information about the interview. That there had been
About this opening language? I understand that all matters discussed are confidential. What would a reasonable police officer take that to mean?
In addition, the Judge Durker did indicate in his findings that this was included in the forms regarding the Ishmael plan.
Right, they were there at this time. That was in the form.
Okay.
I think the information, it means that it's that they are not supposed to share the information. I think it's like any other.
So you think that the understanding was only that the police officer would preserve a confidence, but not that the questioning, interrogating officer would also be bound by confidentiality?
Yes, I think that that's what the testimony was of what that piece was and why it's no longer there.
You don't know where it came from.
However, I don't know where it came from.
Okay.
And I think, you know, it's apparent that it isn't confidential because it was shared up the line to impose discipline. It was shared with the Board of Police Commissioners. It was shared with the police chief. So it did go outside the room. Mm-hmm.
Did you request attorney's fees to your judgment?
So the original petition requests attorney's fees.
When we're talking about 2010 or?
The original, no, okay. We're talking 2007.
Okay.
So we requested attorney's fees. We were awarded attorney's fees in 2010 for up to that piece. And then when the judgment was being entered here, we asked for attorney's fees again.
Okay. You may proceed.
Okay. If there are any other questions, thank you.
Mm-hmm. 3 minutes.
May it please the court, if I can respond. With regard to your question, Judge Mooney, about the advice of rights in the Garrity Statement, Rule 7 of the Police Manual, and specifically it's Rule 7, Section 010, provides that documents prepared as part of an internal investigation may never be shared with a criminal investigator, and those documents include the ARTS form, which we're talking about, the Garrity statements, transcripts of the Garrity statements, consent to discipline, and the rule specifically provides that these reports are confidential and we will be treated as personnel, I have trouble with personal and personnel records, unless otherwise ordered by a court of competent jurisdiction. So the authority came not just from the statement itself, but from the board's own operating rules and regulations, which the IAD and the chain of command all the way up are bound to comply with. So it's the board's own rules that created the confidentiality.
Let me make mention of this issue that I talked to Mr. Lawson about just briefly, and that is, to your judgment, because I gather this winding down process of transfer of jurisdiction is still going on, this court need do nothing because the records are already in Judge Durker's custody and the board acknowledges he's still representing the board and continuing their efforts here. So the city at this juncture does not have to be added or substituted or anything.
That's our position with respect to the records, but I would not speak to the attorney's fee issue. Mm-hmm. That's not my bailiwick.
Yes.
Also, I want to speak to the permissive closure. Again, Mr. Rothard argued that it was always permissive, but that's not the case because the board, again, was not only bound by Rule 7, was bound by Rule 7 and the operating procedures, so employees did have an expectation of privacy because under the department's own rules, these were required to be kept closed, and now there's now a statute that also requires these records.
So are you saying the board was guilty of some misconduct in agreeing to the original judgment that it was open?
The board never agreed to the original judgment.
Well, they didn't appeal the issue.
But I don't think the board not appealing the judgment said that we agree these records are open. They just simply didn't want to spend the money and the time to prosecute the appeal. They never ever said that the records were open or that we're voluntarily turning these records open, over.
Could you go back to Rule 7? And I believe the tail of that was, unless ordered by a
court of competent jurisdiction.
So how do you get around that?
Well, because if there's litigation, there could be an instance in which the court ordered the records. Thank you, Your Honor.
This matter will be taken under submission.